music and talk radio about all things all genders. This is Intravenous, live on CJSF 90.1 FM, discussing and approaching contemporary gender issues through a feminist lens. Our goal is to educate, engage, and challenge the dominant hegemony. This episode is produced in partnership with West Coast Women in Engineering, Science, and Technology.
This is the Best of the West, inspiring women with real stories, hosted by West Coast Women in Engineering, Science, and Technology.
Hello, and welcome to Best of the West. I'm your host, Danielle, and today I'm speaking with Erin Jacob, who is a conservation scientist at the Yellowstone to Yukon Conservation Initiative, also known as Y2Y. At Y2Y, Erin's research informs practical collaborative conservation across the 3,200-kilometer Yellowstone to Yukon region. She earned her Bachelor of Science at the University of British Columbia and her PhD at McGill University and in Uganda. She conducted postdoctoral research at the University of Victoria and in the Great Bear Rainforest. Erin is active in science communication and policy engagement, serves as a board member for the Society for Conservation Biology's North America section, and was a member of the Lieber, Arrow, and Wilberforce Fellowships for Conservation Science. Welcome to the podcast, Erin.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for joining us. Why don't we start with you telling us a bit about what occupies your days?
So I feel really lucky because I really did land my dream job. It's a wonderful combination of research, of policy engagement, and of communication across a fantastic landscape. The Y2Y region is beautiful. It's important for people and for nature, and it feels really good to work here. So some of the things that I do, like in the last couple of weeks, I've spent some time out in the field with our conservation partners, which is great because anytime you you get to go hiking for work and talk about nature is a good day. Talking about different ways that people are trying to conserve the landscape, our interests in different wildlife species, and how people can learn to live in balance with nature better. I spend a lot of time on email and in meetings in front of my computer and talking to people, which is also an important part of conservation. And I get to do a lot of fun things like talking to policymakers, government, media, and especially with students. I love working with researchers who are active in the region and who are doing all different kinds of science, things that I'm not an expert in and that they can really bring a different perspective in.
That sounds amazing. So you said you landed your dream job. How did you get there?
It was a winding road, to be honest. So I grew up partly in East Africa and partly in different parts of Canada. And my work during undergrad and after undergrad kind of reflects that. After undergrad, I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I spent 4 years in doing different kinds of research technician positions, teaching, consulting, and I'd spend a year in East Africa and then a year in northern BC or Alaska. And then go back to East Africa. And during that time, it was incredible. I got to live and work in phenomenal places, trying out all kinds of different things. And it helped me to narrow down my interests in working with people, in practical conservation, and in having science really play a role in solving these big, messy problems. So my PhD work in Western Uganda was on the restoration of tropical rainforests. But after that, I wanted to come and work back in North America on conservation planning, doing more about the engagement of people in these kind of decisions. And then I love my postdoc work, but one day I opened my email inbox and I had emails from about four different people who all said, I just saw this job posting and you'd be perfect for it. You have to apply. And it was this job that I've been in for about the last year and a half, and it's leading conservation related research, across, such an such an incredible area of Western North America, and doing it in a really collaborative way. One of the things I love about Y2Y is that it is collaborative vision for conservation. Not everybody thinks the same way all the time, and we need that diversity of perspectives. And we need to have a really long-term vision of what it looks like to have people and nature thriving in this landscape.
Wow, what an incredible job. Such a great story. Were there key events or people along the way that helped you get to this point?
You know, it's funny when you look back on 10 or 15 years, and as you're going through it, you don't always know what the pivotal moments are. But looking back on it, it really is interesting. And I might get emotional here because it means a lot to me to talk about some of these important people. I can't underscore enough how important my mom has been, who, although she's not a scientist, has always been an advocate for nature and for people, especially for community development. And that's been phenomenally important to me about thinking about the importance of equity and of justice in these kind of decisions, and being brave, thinking about what can you do to make a difference. As well, when I was a postdoc, I was accepted into something called the Wilberforce Fellowship in Conservation Science. It's a year-long training program for conservation scientists working across Western North America. And I had incredible mentors there, including Amanda Stanley, who's now the executive director of Compass Science Communication. And the other fellows, there were 20 of us all together, and they're still some of my favorite collaborators. They're the best cheerleaders, and they're the most constructive critics. People who really help to push you to do your best. And when things don't work out, they're also there to help commiserate, and to eat the cheesecake with you. There are many people who help me as well in support, because sciences can be really difficult and conservation can be really challenging. And getting through the last couple of years of grad school was really tough. So I had a number of peer mentors who were right down there in the trenches. And that is incredibly important to go along. It really does take a huge number of people to get this kind of work done.
Wow, it sounds like you really had an amazing support network there.
Yeah, I'm grateful to so many different people, and many of them may not know, you know, how important their contributions were. And sometimes it's fleeting, and sometimes it's people that you work with for months or even for years.
Yeah. So, I mean, all those wonderful people aside and getting your dream job and all of that, what has been your proudest accomplishment so far?
Yeah, I think the thing that I look back on and I think that was a real journey, a real accomplishment was submitting my PhD thesis. And there were many days, weeks and months that I didn't think I could do it. It is personally hard. It's intellectually hard. It's a real marathon, and it is incremental progress. So that one day that you finish everything up and you click the submit button, whew, it feels like dragging yourself across the finish line of a long marathon. And I often look back at that and I think, boy, not much else in life is going to be that tough. But we'll see. Maybe it will be.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, it really takes a commitment to finish something like that. What inspired you, and maybe this was long ago or more recent, what inspired you to pursue a career in an education in a STEM field?
I was always interested in animals, like so many kids. You know, I was one of those children who could rattle off the breeds of 100 different dogs at the drop of a hat, and was interested in bugs and things like that. But I also wanted to do human rights work. When I was in finishing high school and first year of university, I was really interested in international humanitarian law and refugee issues. And so it took me a couple of years to see biology and specifically conservation as an opportunity to do things that are good for people and for the planet. It does sound really cheesy, but that's okay. I'm okay being cheesy. I feel really good about working on things that should try to fix problems.
That's amazing. I too really resonate with STEM because you get to, you know, tackle problems and make a difference in the world.
Yeah, and it's really creative. I think that's one of the wonderful things about STEM careers, and maybe people who aren't in STEM don't necessarily see that. science, technology, engineering, you know, math is creative as well, and beautiful, elegant. These are really fun things.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more. So, Erin, do you want to share with us a bit about what your undergraduate experience was at university? What was that like? And do you have any fun stories?
I went into university expecting that it would be kind of like high school. And if I did my homework, I would get good grades. And my first couple of years were not easy and were not good grades. I did struggle with some classes, and it was both the support I had at home. My mom was a constant support of you can do this. And, you know, it also, if you fail a class, it's not the end of the world. It's not great, but it's not the end of the world. But I had a physics professor in first year who was incredible for all of his students. But he would be available any time of the day that you were walking past his office and you had a question. You could pop in and talk to him. And that was great because I felt like I could ask stupid questions about the world. Like, if the earth has so much gravity, why doesn't the moon just get sucked into us? And it was looking back on it, a really important time to be able to ask a university professor who's busy and has a lot of other things to do than maybe entertain strange questions from eager undergrads. But being able to talk about that with somebody was really unusual for me. I almost went into physics actually because of that. And it was other things on campus. I was really involved on campus, which probably won't surprise people who know me, in student leadership and residence life and things like that. I definitely went in pretty gung-ho in university, but it took me a couple of years to get into the classes that I loved and then to excel in them.
Yeah, I think that's a really common experience. I definitely had that whiplash of expecting university was going to be approximately like high school, and it's very, very different.
Yeah, and it does make a difference for scholarships. You know, I applied for graduate funding a few times, and I got rejected, which is one of the reasons I spent 4 years doing different research, like research technician jobs, because I couldn't get NSERC funding. And then finally, I'd got enough experience, and my letter writers were writing things like, you know, she's doing graduate level research right now as a tech, and so I was able to kind of overcome those first couple of years of bad grades.
You know, that's a really important thing to point out, that a lot of people think, oh, one bad grade and you're just done. But that's just not the case. There are often ways that you can navigate around past, you know, mistakes. I mean, we're young kids when we start university, even though we think we know everything. So, so going off that, what tips and tricks do you have for students kind of starting out?
Yeah, I think it is important to get as good grades as you can, because unfortunately many of the steps forward are based on things like your GPA. You know, there's a 80% cutoff or something like that, and if you're 79%, you just don't make the cutoff. So that's a separate problem. And things for students to get practical experience. Go and talk to your profs and your TAs. Be that student who says, "Oh, can I get a job in the lab for the summer? Can I learn to band birds?" Maybe you find out you don't like banding birds, and then the next summer you want to do something. You want to do something else. You want to study amphibians. Go and do that. So get your hands dirty with some practical experience. And as well, practice being a good friend and a good peer. So find the people who are also good to each other and try to work with those people. Those are some of the folks I worked with in undergrad are still friends and collaborators, which is amazing. And our networks grow bigger and bigger over time. So it's good practice personally and professionally to be a good friend and a good mentor and a good peer.
Very good advice. Well, you've talked a lot about some really positive stuff throughout your career. I'm going to press you to tell us a bit about a less than great moment or a challenge that you've faced along the way.
There's certainly been a number of them. And some are things that I think many people struggle with, like funding or time and project management. I had a lot of imposter syndrome during grad school. I felt like I wasn't doing, quote, real science because my study wasn't perfectly designed. You know, the real world is complicated and unexpected things happen. And you have to get used to that and figure out what you're going to do. But the biggest challenge that I had has been dealing with harassment. And that is unfortunately not an uncommon experience for people, especially for women. That was very difficult because you feel trapped professionally, or I did, like I was invested so much and that my career would be ruined when it had barely begun. And yet, you haven't done anything to bring that on. It's difficult because sometimes people don't believe you or they judge you. And it's one of the things that's super important is to change that that culture, make it easier for people to report those things, make there more support for people when they do. And diversifying STEM so that we have a wider representation of mentors and breaking down those kind of barriers.
Yeah, wow. Thank you so much for sharing. I mean, that's a really top of mind issue that we really hope wouldn't be an issue. And I think I agree that we're trying to put more supports in place to help people who do come forward about those kinds of things.
Yeah, and unfortunately to destigmatize some of the experiences, not to say that it's okay, but not to hide it so much and to hold people accountable to do something about it.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. So shifting away from the not so pleasant things, why don't you share with us your favorite thing about the field of conservation?
Yeah, it would be hard. It's hard to choose my favorite one. I wake up every day and I truly feel inspired about doing this kind of work. Some days it's a little bit harder than others, but it always feels like we're moving towards a good goal. Even when I'm out hiking, like on the weekend and, I'm on a mountaintop or a ridgeline, I love looking out over that big, vast area and thinking about wildlife moving around in there. Thinking about animals in far flung parts of the world that might never see a person, that might never hear the sound of a vehicle, and just go about their lives. So I love that conservation is an opportunity to do things well, to live better on the planet, to find solutions for people that will work in the long term and be sustainable. I really feel genuinely inspired by that kind of work, and also finding people who also want to work towards common goals is great. Conservation is something that requires everybody from economists to politicians to biologists like me to urban planners and folks that are thinking big, thinking about making positive change.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel inspired by that.
Come work in conservation.
There you go. So how do you see your field changing in the future?
I hope that we're making decisions about the environment on the long term. I hope that it includes, it positions the importance of ecological health, of wildlife, in a way that is going to be beneficial over the long run, so that we're not making short-term economic decisions and then ruining the day that we've made those kind of choices. I want there to be public policy that's informed by evidence, not just by lip service. And also, I think it's really important that conservation in particular has a diversity of views and perspectives. So it's not just people who think one way or have always done studied something in one way, but being open to new ideas, maybe that's other disciplines in STEM, also other ways of knowing, indigenous ways of knowing, including the perspectives of local people, and more interdisciplinarity. As well, I think it's really important that we have more women and people of color in positions of leadership. So I hope to see conservation science in the future that represents more the world that we live in.
Those are all really good hopes for the future. I like it. So Erin, do you want to tell us a bit about how your work relates to the world at large and where maybe our listeners may come into contact with the work that you're doing?
Anybody who has been to the Yellowstone to Yukon region, and that includes Banff National Park, Waterton, Jasper, any of those national parks in the Rocky Mountains, or many provincial parks in British Columbia, Alberta, the Yukon, the Northwest Territories, has seen how beautiful this landscape is. You might have been fortunate enough to see some of the incredible wildlife species that are here. And this area still has the same complement of large mammal species that were present when Europeans first came to North America. So that's amazing. That's where we still have important wildlife species. And if you've driven along the Trans-Canada Highway in Banff National Park, you probably went underneath these big overpasses. It's a bridge for wildlife to get from one side of the road to the other. And that's a project that Yellowstone to Yukon and many partners from government, from independent researchers, from private philanthropists, foundations have worked on for a number of years. And it's a classic example of the importance of ecological connectivity. So we know that roads are a barrier for animal movement, and that animals getting hit by vehicles is bad for the animal, and it's also bad for people. We get hurt, people die, it's really expensive. So solving this kind of problem using wildlife crossing structures is just one example of the many ways that people are thinking about landscape, about conservation on a large landscape scale. So the scale that animals need in order to thrive. And every time I drive underneath one of those overpasses, or I drive over one of the many underpasses that people don't notice, it reminds me how important it is to think on that kind of a scale.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great example. So what positive impact would you hope to see the Y2Y work have in the future?
I hope that we have a vision of a hundred year vision, and that's a system of interconnected lands and waters and a place where people and wildlife will thrive. So I hope that in the future, I'll be out of a job. I hope that we will be living in places where wildlife can thrive and where people have livelihoods that support conservation, and people are thriving as well.
That sounds really amazing. Erin, in the next 5 to 10 years, I mean, you said you might be out of the job. We'll see. But where do you see your career path taking you?
There are so many things that we can do in the Yellowstone to Yukon region, in research questions to be answered, ways to connect that information to live better on the landscape, to inform municipal and regional planning, policy, and to communicate those kind of research findings. I feel like I could be here easily for the next 5 to 10 years. And one of the things that I want to be working on going forward is to help convene other researchers who are interested in that kind of work and that kind of applied conservation so that they too can be advocates for their science, so that they can communicate the results of their work, and so that we'll have many more people who can speak about their knowledge, about people who can get in, who want to do really practical applied research, so that they'll have a place to engage in that.
Wow, that sounds really promising and fun. How do you plan for that future of your career?
Well, planning is needed both on the landscape and personally. So I think it is important for people to take that kind of planning to heart, and to think about what are their goals in the short term, and maybe that's over the next 4 months, or maybe it's for the week. And then also, how do those goals scale up over time? So what are the professional things that you want to accomplish, and what are the personal things that you want to accomplish? Sometimes those kind of things are connected. So I think it is important that we try to not just see ourselves as working all the time. What are the fun things that we want to do? What are the milestones we want to achieve? So having those kind of big lofty goals is one thing, but breaking them down into what are the steps that I'm going to do next? How will I reward myself for getting to those places? And really importantly, it's okay if you stumble and if you fall. If you don't achieve that one goal, life isn't over, let's hope. And there's opportunities to learn from that. So being gentle with ourselves about, well, maybe I bit off more than I can chew, or, that didn't go quite the way I'd hoped, but what can I learn from it? Who can help me in the future? And how can I leverage those kind of lessons for other people so that other people aren't making the same mistakes?
Wow, great answer. That sounds great. So going kind of off of that, How do you define success, and what does that look like for you?
So sometimes it's how I feel. It's waking up in the morning and being excited about what I do, and being in your element where your skills and your expertise are aligned with your interests. So it's really having your head and your heart aligned, and going forward, feeling like you're making a difference in the way that you want to. And so you're using your skills and knowledge, but you're doing something that you feel really good about. And another part of it is reflecting back on what are those milestones you wanted to achieve, and if those boxes were ticked. But more importantly, rather than just, you know, chalking up a list of publications or grants or something like that, it's what did you do with it? So what was the outcome of that work? What did it help to change something on the ground? Is there a measurable benefit to people or to wildlife? And I don't think we often do a good job of studying that, or of setting that up kind of as an experiment. And we don't want to think about ourselves as part of a grand experiment, but we are. Did the thing that we tried to do, did it achieve the outcome we wanted? And if yes, great. Like, what's contributed to that success? And if not, what can you do differently next time?
Well, Erin, it sounds like you have a pretty good balance in how you define success. Let's talk a little bit about work-life balance. What does that look like for you? And do you feel like you have a balance?
Work-life balance, yes. That is the lifelong pursuit. You remember when I said before it's okay to fall off the horse and you have to get back on? I feel like that about work-life balance. And one of the big lessons for me is not to worry about that so much. I used to be a bit more worried, like, oh gosh, I've worked 55 hours this week. I really need to relax. And now I think more like, well, this is a busy time. Okay, well, but we're going to get through it. And then take some time off and enjoy and celebrate. And I think part of that is accepting that we're all going to work a bit differently. Some people do work hard and then play hard. Some people do want to have more structure and more of a routine. Both of those things are okay. And I think if you're in a really busy time that you need to get through, or you just have a high intensity job and maybe you love that, then it becomes even more important to find those micro breaks to take a pause and check in with your body to get decent amount of exercise and sleep and all of those good things. So part of it is accepting that I like to work hard and I like to play hard. So it's okay. That's okay with me. I used to worry about it a bit more, like I had to figure out the exact kind of routine and stick to it so I would have my rigid work-life balance. And now I'm a bit more flexible about it.
Yeah, I think a lot of people have that same experience that you had of really being worried about finding that perfect, you know, balance and that there's a right answer. And after asking this question to every podcast guest, we can see that, like you said, people work differently and that sometimes things are just busier and it's better to carve out the space where it makes sense for you. So, yeah, I think it's a really interesting thing to look at when we talk to all sorts of people, just to say, like, there's not a perfect answer and there's not a perfect formula that works for everyone.
Exactly. And sometimes I think it comes back to planning as well. Sometimes you can look ahead, you know, lift your head up and kind of scan the horizon and think, oh, is that a busy period coming up? If it is, like, say you have, I've had back-to-back conferences this summer. I knew that I was going to have to schedule some downtime afterwards. And that involved going to, you know, to my family's camp on a lake and lying on the beach for a few days and not doing anything. You need to be gentle with yourself, but also to plan for that. Because otherwise we do run into burnout, and that doesn't help anybody.
Yeah, absolutely. So going off of that, what are your tips for dealing with stress?
Some of it is trying to see things in the big picture and the long term. So that helps me let things roll off my back more, maybe more than they used to. I think that's also probably a product of being older and juggling more things. So you can't let one thing absolutely ruin your day. Another part is really trying to see it like a marathon, not a sprint. So I'm going to have to, what are the few things that I'm going to put a ton of work into, and see what else can you cut out, and being okay with that. Learning to meditate was a really important skill for me, and that was at the end of graduate school. And I also approached it kind of with this